I got online and entered Timmer's GPS coordinates. A red flag appeared on a hair-thin road near Lake Wylie, South Carolina, just south of Charlotte. My friend Anne had been listing and selling properties in the area for decades, mostly high-end homes, in and around a golf course development called River Hills. Still, she knew the turf. I hit speed dial.
"I can hardly hear you, Tempe."
Hollow air with lots of background noise.
"I'm at a Knights game."
"Quick question?"
"Shoot."
"Do you know Lone Eagle Lane near Lake Wylie?"
"Donegal Lane?"
shouted. "Lone Eagle." As Anne searched terrain in her mind, an amplified voice gave a stroke-worthy whoop. The crowd noise swelled, receded.
"Yeah, Lone Eagle runs along behind the nature preserve, accesses some old-style cottages dating back to the post-war years. You pick the war."
"Waterfront?"
"Yes."
The din was receding. Anne was moving to a quieter location.
"I'm surprised some builder hasn't slapped condos on the property."
"Developers contact me all the time. The homeowners say they've been going to the river all their lives and have no interest in selling."
"What else is back there?"
"To my knowledge, fuck all."
"Ever hear of a real estate company called Deep Haven?"
"Dipshit name from a marketing perspective, but no."
"Any chance a realtor could have opened an office on Lone Eagle?"
"Anything's possible since those neutron stars collided."
"What?
The gravitational waves?"
"Enjoy the game. We're losing by 4 runs, but the peanuts rock."
"Why the interest in Lone Eagle Lane?"
"No reason."
"Uh-huh.
If the old coots have decided to sell, I want in."
I returned to Google Earth and shifted to aerial view. My eyes confirmed what the map and Anne had said. Lots of shoreline, lots of fuck all. Knowing the idea was pure insanity, I decided on a drive-by. What could it hurt? Another courtesy call to Slidell, then phone and flash at the ready, I set out. Chapter 22. Wylie, one of 11 man-made reservoirs strung like clots along the Catawba River, has 352 miles of shoreline meandering through both Carolinas. The Allen Steam Station is located at the lake's northern end near Charlotte. The Catawba Nuclear Generating Station dominates a peninsula in its southwestern part. I once read an NRC disaster emergency plan that defined plume exposure and ingestion pathway zones. Needless to say, fish from these waters don't figure into my diet. Despite the presence of gorilla reactors, the lake is a popular residential and recreational area, a schizoid mix of nouveau-riche McMansion and golf course communities, retirement condos, and Dukes of Hazzard-type trailers and shacks. Lots of barbecue and boat supply stores. 30 minutes after we left the annex, Slidell turned right from Shopton Road. Yeah, I was shocked too. He'd phoned back within minutes, insisted on a tag-team approach. I had no choice. Though, truth be told, I was glad not to be tackling this one solo. Dusk was yielding to night, and everything around us was monochrome gray. I'd never ventured into the area but knew that the McDowell Nature Preserve and Copperhead Island Park were somewhere to the south, the Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden off to the west, across the water. A left, then another right. The streets were poorly lit, the homes modest ranches and bungalows. No gates, no guards demanding ID. Driveways ended under carports or just ended. Bikes lay on lawns that were mowed, not professionally landscaped. Porch lights were coming on. Two boys kicked a soccer ball far down the block. A dog of indeterminate breed yapped and dashed from kid to kid. A short distance, then my Google Maps app said to go right. Slidell did, at a non-threatening green street sign, Lone Eagle Lane. Below that, a not-so-welcoming declaration. Dead end. Lone Eagle was as empty and still as an abandoned movie set.
Slidell eased to a stop. When we lowered our windows, hot air engulfed us like steam off soup. I smelled water, gasoline, algae, and mud, a hint of pine. On my side loomed a wall of old-growth cypress, interrupted here and there by a hut or shed. On Slidell's side, across the narrow pavement, cottages crouched dark and sullen along the shore. Quick glance over my shoulder, 20 yards back, an empty lot separated two lakeside homes. Paralleling the lot's right boundary, a concrete slab sloped gently into the water. Waves lapped sluggishly at the slab's far end, audible but invisible in the thickening dark.
"Boat ramp," I said.
Slidell said nothing. We both logged its position, then the forerunner crept forward. I soon realized the street was far from deserted. Conservation, tradition, whatever the reason, lights were shunned on Lone Eagle on hot summer nights, maybe always. Despite the self-imposed gloom, perhaps because of it, people were out on their porches and stoops, rocking, talking, smoking cigarettes that sparked like tiny orange fireflies. Anne's old coots. I sensed displeasure at our intrusion. As we proceeded, the road rose in elevation. I felt hostile eyes tracking our uphill climb. 5 houses, 8, 12. Suddenly, loud as gunfire, my iPhone proclaimed our arrival. Jesus H. Christ, they probably heard that in the next county. I muted the sound and raised my window. Slidell slowed but didn't stop. We both glanced left. The cottage didn't stand out structurally. 1-story frame, window AC units, veranda in front, carport on the near side, chain-link fence enclosing the rear. The first difference involved cars. Unlike the others we'd passed, this driveway hosted a small fleet. The second involved illumination. Behind shuttered windows, every room appeared to be lit. The third involved neighbors. Being last before the promised dead end, there was nothing on the far side but a hill covered with holly and other inhospitable vegetation. Slidell cruised past, looped around the cul-de-sac, and retraced our path. Pulling onto a narrow dirt strip fronting the cypresses, we observed. Saw no human form at a car, in the yard, or on the porch. But a prism of rainbow colors flickered around the edges and through the closed slats of shutters covering windows facing the dead end. "Someone's home," I said. Wordlessly, we got out, crossed the street and the lawn, and climbed the steps. A sign on the door said, "No admittance after presentation begins." Seeing no bell, I knocked. 0 response. I tried the knob. The door was locked. I checked the fence. The sole gate was secured by a very large padlock.
"That's it," Slidell said. "We're out of here."
"I want to know what's going on in there."
"The homeowner ain't exactly inviting us in. And I got no jurisdiction and no cause.
This is our only lead to Vodyanov. Maybe to those kids. Let's try a different tack." One long-suffering look, then Slidell pivoted and headed for the car. I followed, certain he intended to lead-foot it back to Charlotte. Instead, he drove downhill, past our entrance point, pulled in at the boat ramp, and cut the engine.
"They don't open up willingly? We're done."
"Roger that." I shoved my phone into a pocket, the flash into my waistband, and got out. It was full night now, no moon, no street lamp. Around us, only darkness and hot, stagnant air. A small colony of neurons urged retreat. Ignoring the warning, I stepped onto the concrete. The surface was slick with algae, forcing me to move gingerly. At my back, Slidell slip-slid and cursed indignantly. To either side, the land dropped without drama to a narrow ribbon of rock and sand. To call it a beach would be unfair to beaches. Wooden piers ran from the edge of the ribbon out over the water. Most had a rowboat or canoe tied to an upright. We maneuvered to the side of the concrete,
worked our way downward and, using our flashes sparingly to avoid drawing attention, set off along the shore. Far distant, across the water, lights twinkled with multicolored cheer. Now and then, the muggy air stirred on a rare breeze, carrying the murmur of waves listlessly brushing pilings, the muted hum of a distant outboard motor. As my eyes adjusted, I could see that the ground was littered with debris. When lit, my beam crawled over dead fish, empty sunblock tubes, the long tentacles of twisted plastic grocery bags. 10 minutes beyond the ramp, a rocky breakwater jutted toward the shore like a long arthritic digit. In my scramble across, generations of algae transferred to my person. If Slidell and I did encounter Yates Timmer, we were going to look like creatures from some dark lagoon. Paralleling the gradient on Lone Eagle Lane, the beach angled upward. Panting and perspiring, we forged on. Though less enthused now, I was determined to see the escapade through to its conclusion.
"This is the goddamn stupidest thing you've ever dragged my ass into."
Slidell was breathing hard. I hoped I wasn't dragging his ass into a cardiac event. The straps of my sandals, grown soggy and gritty, sawed channels into my heels and the tops of my feet. My clothing molded to me like a second skin. How had the distance seemed so much shorter in the Forerunner? Behind me, I could see Slidell crunching and wheezing. At any second, I was certain he'd order retreat. Then, without warning, the shoreline cut in, and the bank to our right rose sharply. Google Maps flashed bright and mutely announced we were at the programmed GPS coordinates. I thumbed on my flash and pointed it toward the water. The pier was bigger than most and had a pontoon boat moored beside it. As Slidell's beam fell on the pontoon, I aimed mine right. It landed on a narrow flight of wooden stairs. I ran the light up the steps, could see nothing beyond the top one. As one, we killed our lights and listened for movement above us. I caught only Slidell's breathing and the blood pulsing in my ears. "Jesus, Brennan, the guy's a realtor, not Polyphemus. He owns a party boat." One fiercely unfriendly glance, then Slidell began climbing, cautiously testing before putting his full weight onto each tread. White-knuckling the rail, I followed. Topside, a zillion tree frogs chirped amphibian gossip, maybe crickets. I risked a nanosecond to flash, so did Slidell. A path led from the stairs to a gate, then across a small yard to the cottage. Surprisingly, the back door was ajar. A violet-blue slash cut through the gap, lighting a deck holding a Weber grill and angular shapes that looked like rockers and patio chairs. The gate was unlocked. Slidell disengaged the lever and strode to the deck.
"Yo!"
Same result as out front. Silence. He shouted again. Still no response. Slidell palmed the door open. We both stepped inside. We were in a kitchen, lit by overhead recessed cans. Faux brick tile floor, farm-style sink, stainless steel appliances. The refrigerator was just to our right. Through a glass panel, I could see containers of Ocetra and Beluga caviar, smoked duck, foie gras, and lump crab meat. Enough cheeses to feed all of Wisconsin. At the room's center was a plank pine table, 8 bamboo placemats, 8 chairs, 1 askew, as though hastily vacated. At the table's center, a ceramic vase with a pink calla lily in its prime. A clipboard lay on the mat in front of the off-angle chair. I walked over, glanced down, and noted a list of names, all but 2 checked. Beside the clipboard, a crystal tumbler holding an inch of amber liquid. Slidell joined me and picked up the glass, sniffed.
"Hello."
He extended his arm. I inhaled, ID'd cognac or brandy. Straight ahead, opposite the back entrance and beside a wolf range, was a closed door. From beyond it came what sounded like a recorded voice, the cadence suggesting TV or film dialogue. To the right of the closed door, an open one,
allowed a view into a pantry. We crossed to it. On the floor were cases of liquor and wine. Macallan, Patron, Tito's, Remy Martin. The wines were mostly domestic Pinot Noirs and French Burgundies. Good ones. I knew. Light reds had been my poison of choice. Godiva chocolates and other delicacies filled the shelves. Walker shortbread cookies, jars of olives and tiny cornichon pickles. Boxes of cigars displaying the word Habana.
"Looks like someone's planning a party," Slidell said, voice muted.
"That someone's a mighty big spender." Then a high-voltage shot of adrenaline. In one corner, a stack of cocktail napkins with the word Deep Haven in royal blue script.
Holy shit.
What?
I'll explain later, as I captured the napkins with my phone. Beyond the closed door, the cinematic voice droned on. As Slidell moved into the pantry to inventory the shelves, I scurried over and put my ear to the wood, made out a few words, maybe safety, maybe threat. I was repositioning for better acoustics when a hinge squeaked at my back. I whirled. A man stood in the doorway, feet spread, fingers fumbling with his fly. A plastic badge on his shirt introduced him as Bing. A rainbow tattoo on one forearm showed a snarling reptile and said, "Florida Gators." A tug, another, then Bing gave up and braced with a hand to the frame. He was large, in a linebacker gone to fat way. A slack jawline and blonde fringe struggling to form brows and cover his scalp said Bing's gridiron days were far in the past. My gaze found Slidell's. His eyes narrowed as he indicated his badge and shook his head. I dipped my chin in acknowledgement of his desire to conceal that he was a cop. The door was open. As Slidell listened from the pantry, I spoke up, not wanting to startle. If my presence unnerved Bing, he gave no indication. Taking me in with bloodshot eyes, he said, "Had to piss." Understandable. The scraggly brows dipped as my algae-stained state penetrated to Bing's brain. Walked over along the beach. To distract, I wiggled a finger at Bing's unzipped pants. "You wanna..."
"Sorry."
After clumsily achieving success,
"I need to verify you're invited."
"Sure." Bing walked to the table, not stumbling, but clearly unsteady.
"Name?"
"Flora." One of the unchecked pair on the list.
"You're not..."
"I'm a friend of Flora's. She said it would be all right if I came in her place." A beat, then.
"You got ID?"
"I'm sorry. I didn't want to haul my purse. It's really big. You know how women are." Silly woman grin. "I left everything behind in my car. I suppose I could go all the way back to get it." More puzzled brows, then a steroidal arm arced.
"You can't go in until they're finished."
"So I get to hang with you?" Accompanied by a flirtatious smile. Blushing, which did not improve his appearance, Bing reoriented the arm, still upraised, in the general direction of the table. I sat.
"They'll be tied up an hour, maybe longer."
"Oh my."
"Buy a lady a drink?"
The dolt actually said that. "Please, sir." I actually said that. Bing walked to a cabinet, returned with a second tumbler and an open bottle of Courvoisier, dropping beside me with a whoosh of cheap cologne and an alarming creaking of wood, he poured us each 3 inches of cognac. "I'll bet you played football," I said, eyes roving, discreetly seeking options for an exit plan.
"Defensive tackle."
Bing knocked back 2 of his 3 inches.
"Wow."
Beaming feigned admiration, I pretended to drink.
"I can still bench press 350.
"That's awesome." I had no idea. Bing tried to rest his chin on his palm. It slipped off.
"Oops," he said, grinning.
"Oops," I said, grinning. Bing drained, then refilled his tumbler
leaned close and placed the gator hand on my arm.
I gotta lock up here tonight, but you wanna wait? I'll drive you to your car, or wherever.
The roomy leer made me want an immediate shower. That's so kind, taking another sham sip.
Your boss must be a really good guy, sharing such expensive cognac.
Bing winked.
It's our little secret.
I'll bet your job allows you to meet loads of interesting people. Humble hitch of one shoulder. Have you met Felix Vodianov?
Casual as hell.
The leer cooled. I'd said something wrong. I only ask
You want more brandy?
Withdrawing his hand.
This is lovely, but I'm actually more of a scotch drinker.
Hold on.
As Bing lurched off, I poured my cognac into the lily. A glance at the list revealed my mistake.
I'm so sorry. I know I shouldn't have used a last name, I said when my glass held Glenfiddich and the bottle sat beside it.
Bing repeated the one-shoulder shrug.
Flora explained, contrite. I forgot.
It's not a big deal with me, just, you know, house rules.
Won't happen again,
mimicking a key turning over my lips.
For several seconds, the only sound was the muffled narration beyond the door. Has Felix been here recently?
Not lately.
Then a comment Bing's brain hadn't fully vetted.
Haven't seen little brother in a while either.
Little brother? Hoping Slidell was getting all this.
Nick.
Holy hopping shit. Of course. Forcing my voice neutral. Nick's so much fun.
The bleary eyes bugged and the bull neck turtled out.
Are you fucking serious? The guy's an asshole.
You think so?
Fuck.
Speaking in a coquettish whisper, I encouraged. Are we talking about the same Nick?
The guy's a tool.
The booze was now dulling Bing's mind and slurring his speech.
A fucking Russian tool.
Don't overplay. What's that old story about Nick and Felix?
Yeah.
Bing snorted wetly.
They both start out Vodianov, right? But Nick don't want to sound foreign. So he changes the V to B, since that's how it's written in whatever the hell alphabet Ruskies use, and he chops off the end. Vodianov becomes goddamn body.
Bing again drained his glass, smacked down the tumbler. Yeah, I nodded. That's the one.
He probably quit coming because of the fight.
Body? Forming the name with my lips, but not speaking it aloud. Bing shook his head no.
Big brother.
Felix.
Felix, the fall guy.
Mocking.
Klutzoid.
Who did he fight with?
Dude named Twist. I wouldn't hear that night, but things get around.
When was this?
I'm thinking maybe 3-4 weeks back.
Bing's brows dipped again.
Yeah, the 20th. I wasn't working that Wednesday. Don't get that many days off.
June 20th. 2 days before Vodianov's late-night prowl at Sharon Hall.
Another snort.
I heard Felix jump Twist's ass. Quite a move for the little wimp. Can't say I blame him. Twist's another real sleaze.
Why do you say that?
The dickhead's into kiddie porn. In my book, anyone messes with...
Over Bing's shoulder, I saw the closed door swing in toward the stove.
Yates Timmer stood with one hand on the knob. Military glasses pointed squarely at me. Who is this?
Bing fired up so fast, his chair crashed to the floor.
Friend of Flora's.
I see. Unruffled. Her name?
Realizing he'd never asked, Bing tried to segue.
I was showing cordiality, like you coach us.
Did you request ID?
Gaze still on me. Bing stood mute, mouth agape.
I rose. Timmer eyed me a few seconds longer, then...
Have we met?
No.
Bing shot me a furious look, or tried to. The sudden movement forced him to step sideways to regain his balance.
Why are you here?
I'm interested in Deep Haven.
What do you know about Deep Haven?
I'm hoping you'll inform me.
You are an acquaintance of Flora's? I nodded. Her surname, please? I had no answer.
She knows Felix and Nick.
Bing, desperate to justify his actions. Detain her, Timmer said. An entire nation of neurons bellowed retreat. Slidell stepped from the pantry.
Chapter 23. Monday, July 9th to Tuesday, July 10th.
No one's detaining no one.
Slidell's tone was even but glacial. Timmer's eyes hardened behind their army-style lenses. He turned them on Skinny, but spoke to Bing.
Why are these people in my kitchen?
Not unexpectedly, Bing was slow to react.
I was watching her. She wasn't going nowhere.
And the gentleman?
I didn't know he was here.
Sloppy shrug.
He slipped by me.
Slipped by you? Anger swelled in his voice, threatening to surface.
I had to take a leak, all right? You told me never to interrupt the pitch. Since I couldn't cut through the living room to the crapper, I went outside.
Timmer looked at me across the bright pink calla lily, at the cognac and scotch sitting on the table. I will ask you again, miss. What do you want?
Info on Deep Haven.
How did you learn of this place?
Your catchy logo.
We don't advertise.
I viewed your website, took the tour of World's End House.
You are interested in underground living?
Maybe.
Visits to this location are by invitation only. You should contact my office during regular business hours.
I did.
A sliver of a pause, then. You fraudulently claim to know one of my clients. You enter my property under false pretenses.
Somehow, I doubt your veracity, miss.
We're done here.
Slidell jumped in before I could answer.
I could have you both arrested. A hint of aggression in Timmer's voice.
That would be a very bad idea.
To me.
Let's go.
Without warning, Bing launched himself at Slidell in a disorganized, sloppy-jointed, slow-mo lunge. Skinny reacted with more agility than I'd have thought him capable of. In one lightning move, he sidestepped, grabbed Bing's leading shoulder, and, using the forward motion to his advantage, spun and slammed the big man into the wall. Timmer retreated behind the door. Slidell held Bing a long, painful moment, crooking one arm high behind his back. Then,
as I said, we're going now.
Bing grunted and nodded, one beefy cheek tight to the plaster. A few beats, then Slidell released his grip. Bing slid to the floor, a glistening trail of drool and snot marking his descent. With one glare in my direction, Slidell strode past me toward the door. The return trip along the beach was not an experience I want to repeat. Slidell was furious. At me, at Timmer, at being in a situation not fully under his control. Mostly at me.
That was one stupid goddamn waste of time.
It wasn't. We learned several things.
Yeah, like I shouldn't listen to any more of your harebrained ideas.
We learned that Felix Vodyanov and Nick Boddy are brothers. That Vodyanov got into a fight with a guy named Twist. Slidell tripped and stumbled forward. I waited as he regained his balance. We learned that the fight took place 2 days before I spotted Vodyanov prowling my front yard.
If the guy in the trench coat was Vodyanov.
A week after the fight with Twist, Vodyanov turned up dead.
Yeah.
We continued past yards and cottages, still as crypts. Through mud-crusted litter, my breathing was good, my legs strong from the hours of jogging, and the downhill gradient didn't hurt. Beside me, Slidell was struggling. Then, Above Slidell's panting and slogging, I heard a sound. Footsteps? Were Timmer and Bing following us? Others? Cops? Had Timmer called 911? What was that?
We both froze, vigilant for movement ahead, above, or out over the water.
I heard a swish of fabric. Knew Slidell's hand had cocked toward his gun. All was muggy stillness around us.
As we clambered over the algae-slimed outcrop, I worried. Had Timmer deployed his henchmen to discover where we'd parked? Did he have henchmen? Was he planning an ambush at the Forerunner? Or had he simply returned to his movie? Was my paranoia playing more games with my sanity? Minutes, maybe eons, then we finally reached the boat ramp. The Forerunner sat alone in the dark, no Bing, no Timmer, no henchmen.
Thank Christ.
A surprising puff of hot air brushed my skin as we both scrambled up the incline and across the concrete. When Slidell wasn't venting his indignation over one thing or another, we rode to Charlotte in silence, which provided far too much time for reflection. Had Timmer ordered a covert investigation? Surely he wanted to know who we were. It was obvious he hadn't called 911. Was he afraid of a police presence in the cottage? Of an inquiry into the nature of the event and those who were present? Had we blundered into something more sinister than a pitch for the delights of a subterranean abode?
Slidell phoned early the next morning, spent time re-emphasizing themes he'd highlighted during the previous night's trudge down the beach and the endless drive home. Finally got to the point.
Vice boys knew the name right off. Vincent Aiello. Online, goes by Twist.
Good work.
You know that dark web thing you've been talking up?
I wouldn't say I've been.
There was a kiddie porn site down there called PlaySchool. Users went in through some sick-as-shit browser.
Tor?
Sounds right. Keeps your cyber prowling secret, so word on the street had PlaySchool as a nice, safe hidey hole for viewing and trading kiddie porn. Vice guys say there were over 100,000 users and tens of thousands of posts involving sexual abuse and exploitation of minors.
You're using the past tense, hiding my revulsion.
2 years ago, the feds shut the fucker down. They arrested the creator and head administrator, a douchebag in Philadelphia named Sammy Lowenstein, a busload of child porn producers, and a couple hundred U.S.-based users.
Jesus.
Messed up, eh? On the plus side, they also rescued 32 kids.
How does Vincent Aiello figure in?
Your boy Twist was a frequent flyer.
Meaning?
He regularly posted content in the forums.
The FBI snagged Aiello in their net?
Yep. Prosecuted him on a number of counts of engaging in a child exploitation enterprise.
I hope he stays behind bars till his dick falls off. Repugnance now curdling my tone.
Unfortunately, all charges had to be dropped.
Seriously?
To crack into Tor, special agents used what the DOJ describe as, I'm quoting here, a network investigative technique approved by a federal court. Later, a different judge ruled that the FBI had to reveal the nature of said technique in order to move forward with prosecuting Aiello. The Bureau said, "Kiss my sweet cheeks." The turd walked.
Bigger fish?
Apparently, the DOJ has related probes that are still ongoing.
Aiello lives local?
Dilworth.
What's he do?
You ready for this? The guy's a lawyer.
Are you kidding?
Solo practitioner, does something with patents, works out of his home.
Any previous arrests?
In 2010, he was charged with one count of possessing and three counts of transporting child pornography. That's how he came to the notice of CMPD Vice.
Let me guess, he skated.
Got everything thrown out because of a technicality. Apparently, they found the stuff in his car without probable cause to search the vehicle.
Bing said Vidyana fought with Aiello, attacked him, actually, that the incident got him kicked out of Deephaven.
What'd they fight about?
You know what I know.
What the hell is Deep Haven?
I thought it might be a real estate office. Now I'm not so sure.
Because?
Why such an odd location? Why no commercial signage? Why so much security? Why use only the first names of clients?
There was a pause over the line, heavy. Then Slidell summarized aloud what we were both thinking.
Aiello's a pedophile. He's living in Charlotte when Jahan Cole goes missing. The kid's name is in Vodyanov's notebook. Vodyanov gets into a throwdown with Aiello and shortly thereafter turns up dead.
I picked up the thread. Aiello's into kiddie porn but managed to stay under the radar until 2010, then again for the next 6 years. He's a lawyer, he's careful, undoubtedly more so since the FBI bust. We need to question him before he gets wind of our interest.
We don't need to do nothing. Just because I agreed to your little sortie last night don't mean we're now Starsky and Hutch.
Expected. I pressed on anyway. Can you pull Aiello's file, talk to the feds, to the vice detective and prosecutor from 2010?
Sit tight until you hear from me. No promises. Just be ready when I call.
After disconnecting, the revulsion hung on. I was fixed in place, wallowing in it, when a knock sounded on the door. I looked up. Through the window above the sink, I could see a panel truck. Through the one in the door, a stoop-shouldered silhouette wearing a broad-billed white cap. I recognized the long-lost painter. Fred? Frank? I let Fred Frank in. He was in his mid-50s with sullen eyes and pockmarked skin that looked like it had spent its whole life in a cellar. As on our earlier encounters, I suspected that neither Fred Frank's cap nor his matching coveralls had enjoyed the company of detergent in the recent past. Fred Frank and I discussed the errant shade of paint. After he showed me the new color and I approved, he trudged upstairs. Several return trips for a ladder, more cans, brushes, drop cloths, and other paraphernalia, and Fred Frank disappeared into the new study. Recalling Fred Frank's fondness for sun tea, I filled my large glass jar with distilled water, threw in a mix of green hibiscus and peach tea bags, capped it, and set the jar out on the porch. God forbid I should fall short, should Fred Frank grow thirsty. By 10, the place smelled like the inside of a chimney at a chemical plant. Unsure if that was normal or healthy, I decided to vacate. Throughout the morning, I ran errands. After lunch, I began work on an article for the Journal of Forensic Sciences in the downstairs guest room study, with the door closed to head off the fumes. Around 2, heavy clomping on the staircase caught my attention. I peeked out in time to see Fred Frank hurrying down the hall. "All finished?" to his retreating back. "Got a phone call. Gotta go." "But..." I heard the kitchen door open, click shut. Exasperated, I rolled a towel and jammed it along the crack below the door in the upstairs study. The hasty departure felt worryingly familiar. Why, I wondered, had I stuck with this guy? At 6, I left to meet Pete for dinner. His news made thoughts of fickle painters, missing kids, pedophiles, faceless corpses, and strange bunkers dissolve like fog on a hot summer dawn. Pete and I tied the knot young, kept it tied for 2 decades. Then came the nurse, the realtor, the law firm colleague. Unable to ignore the affairs, I left. For years, my simmering anger and his guilt kept us apart. The resentment and self-blame are gone now. We both agree. We're better friends single than we ever were married. Despite the temperature, Pete was on the patio at Toscana, our favorite restaurant since back in the day. He was wearing khaki shorts, a cotton polo, boat shoes, no socks. Standard dress. Pete smiled on seeing me, rose as I crossed to the table. "Tempe." He'd been out of town and we hadn't spoken in a month. As usual, hearing Pete's voice stirred memories long dormant. Snuggling in a carrel in the law school library, his worn leather jacket soft against my cheek, his hair glinting white gold under a full Barbados moon, his eyes beaming joy, infant Katie raised two-handed high above his head, his eyes wide in horror, like those of the lady beside him in our bed. "Hey, Pete," kicking the memories aside. "You look terrific." I didn't. I'd thrown on a sundress, my sole inspiration for coping with the merciless heat. Pete's arms went around me, my cheek brushed his shirt, and my nose took in his Aramis cologne, a scent he refused to supplant with any other. I relaxed into his chest. For a moment, all was as it once was. Sweet Jesus, my overloaded stress-strain curve was turning me into a mooning adolescent. The treasonous glitch in my arterial wiring? Right, Brennan. Blame everything on the aneurysm. I stepped back. The moment ended. We both sat. Through long-standing and hard-won mutual agreement, my ex and I strived to keep all conversations neutral. That night we discussed Katie, Mama, the Hornets' prospects for the upcoming season. When Pete queried my work, I shook my head no. When I asked about his travels, he said they'd involved a Winnebago and Parklands. All righty. As we ate, I tried not to glance at my watch, to wonder what was occupying Slidell. Behind Pete's head, a faulty carriage lantern bulb winked on and off. I absently tracked its sputtering decline. Thought again about the AWOL electrician, resolved to keep nagging until he finished the job in the new study. We were sipping decaf espressos when I said, "Okay, big guy, what's this news that must only be shared in person?" Pete's face went all tight angles and bones. A beat, then he set his tiny china cup on its tiny china saucer. It made a soft chinking sound. Long after, I recalled that odd little detail. My trip was for Boyd. Pete's strange response, his somber tone and obvious tension, I felt a tickle of unease. "For the dog," I said. "Yes." When anxious, I often joke. I did so then. "The chow's worried about the rising cost of admission to national parks?" Unsmiling, Pete took my hand. The gesture, meant to comfort, had the opposite effect. "Boyd has a brain tumor, Tempe. I took him to a specialist in Raleigh." "A tumor?" The bulb was dead, the lantern across the terrace now a hazy cyclops eye. "It's frontal. He's losing vision on the right." I swallowed. "How will they treat it?" Pete squeezed my hand harder. The cold hollowness spread outward. I said nothing. "He loved being out on the trails," Pete said. "I think Acadia was his favorite." I nodded. "Boyd's had a good life." I'm lousy at expressing emotion, at offering condolence. I spoke the first words to come into my head. "It'll be fine." My artless response hung between us on the hot summer air. We both knew it wouldn't be fine. It would be agonizing, heart-wrenching, achingly sad. "I want to see him."
"Of course, we'll..."
"Now."
"Sure."
Pete signaled for the check, paid. I was too devastated to argue. I followed Pete to the house we'd shared for almost 20 years. His now. I waited while he used his key to let us in. We'd barely cleared the door when Boyd came strolling into the foyer, ears at half-mast, tongue dangling purple. Seeing me, the dog went into his usual routine. Not full-out berserk, but pretty excited, circling me and nudging both my hands with his snout. I petted his head and ruffled the fur on his neck, which did nothing to calm the display. At Pete's suggestion, we all moved into the family room. I accepted his offer of coffee, too focused on Boyd to consider the consequences of late-night caffeine. As Pete disappeared into the kitchen, I dropped onto the sofa, leaned forward, and opened my arms. Boyd put his head on my knee, looked up, and rotated his eyebrow whiskers. I gazed into the doleful brown eyes, a million memories colliding in my mind. Fighting tears, I wondered, did the dog know something was amiss in his head? Did he sense his upcoming decline, his death? Was I projecting my own angst onto the Chow, my newborn sense of my own mortality? Pete and I took Boyd for a very long walk. I stayed far later than I should have. While starting the car, I noticed the time on the dashboard clock, 11:37. I wept all the way to the annex. Another shock awaited me there.
Chapter 24. The porch light was on, but the usual squadron of moths wasn't fluttering in the nimbus around it. My ears registered no soft ticking of wings against bulbs. The air smelled of petunias and marigolds and freshly mowed lawn, and something else. An acrid tinge overriding the floral mix. A ghost-like shadow materialized from the darkness at the corner of the house. To either side of it, the ground looked oddly rippled, as though the soil had been gouged, the grass trampled and flattened. My mind logged all the incongruous cues, offered no explanation. Bird? As the cat padded toward me, I checked my surroundings. Still no alarm bells. My gaze fell on the door leading into the kitchen. Dark slashes ran along the edges where the wood should have met the frame. Had the wind knocked it ajar? For those in my line of work, security is second nature, like washing your hands with soap or breathing. Plus, there had been break-ins in the past. No way I'd ever forget to lock up. Seriously, Brennan? Lately, you've been acting like a sparrow caged with a Maine coon. Pete was with me during dinner and later at his house. Katie wasn't in Charlotte. Mama didn't drive after dark. No one else in town had a key. Who? I jumped at the brush of fur on my ankles, squatted and scooped Birdie into my arms. Good boy for hanging close to home. The cat purred and raised his head. I buried my nose behind his right ear. My pulse quickened. He smelled like cinders. Flash image of the incinerator at the fenced bunker. Alert Slidell? Detective Delightful would either go radioactive at being phoned so late or set a land record rushing over to protect my ass. Before dialing, I had to know what the hell was going on, if anything. Another quick glance around, then I eased the door inward and stepped inside. No ski-masked figure lurched from the gloom. Every familiar shape was in its normal position, the sink, the appliances, the table and chairs. But the smell of smoke was unmistakable. Nervous energy must have goosed me into squeezing harder than I realized. Birdie yerped and twisted. With a forepaw brace, he launched from my chest and shot from the room. Lights? I knew the layout. An intruder, if there was one, would not. Advantage to me. Feeling half foolish, half frightened, I crept forward in the dark. The dining room was undisturbed, ditto the living room, the only movement the gentle swaying of the pendulum on the mantel clock. The only sound, its low metronome. But why so black? Usually I leave the hall table lamp burning. I'd also forgotten that. As I inched toward the guest room study, the air felt wrong. Too heavy, too warm. Had the hot mugginess seeped in through the open back door? And why the smell of burning? One peek gave rise to alarm. The room sparkled with a million points of iridescence. A moment of confusion, then comprehension. Light from a street lamp was filtering through a shattered window behind the sofa, sparking shards of glass blanketing the furniture and rug. Birdie was on an end table, a pale fuzzy cutout in the shimmery gloom. His nose was raised, his nostrils testing the out-of-place scents of flowers, grass, and soot. On sensing my presence, he focused round, questioning eyes on me. I had no answer for him. A missile hurled through the window? By accident? On purpose? No foreign object lay embedded in the Aurora Borealis display. A break-in? Was the burglar still in the house? I tried to calm myself to think. Phone Slidell, the old gaggle of wary neurons urged. Yes. Of course, I got voicemail, left a message. 911? Not yet. Why not? I stood, breath frozen, listening for movement upstairs. Heard footsteps, rustling, a soft shh. No pistol being cocked, no semi-automatic slide being ratcheted back, that was good. Ignoring the alarmist neurons, I gathered Birdie and locked him in the pantry. Then I grabbed a hammer, retraced my steps, and stole up the stairs. With each tread, the smoky stench grew stronger. Halfway up, I paused. Was I actually hearing movement, or were the sounds a new fantasy born of my paranoia, of my unbearable grief over Boyd? At the top, my anxiety went suborbital. The thuds and swishes were real and coming from off to the right. I tried to swallow, my mouth was too dry. Tightening my grip on the hammer, I tiptoed down the hallway toward the new shared office. The door was open, the rolled towel kicked to one side. A Coleman LED lantern sat just inside, throwing off-angle slashes of light and shadow upward from its floor-level placement. The room looked like a nuclear bomb had gone off. The south and east walls remained as scorched uprights, backed by mangled exterior siding. Melted wiring dangled from the exposed framing and damaged ceiling. Both desks were destroyed. My patinaed old oak charred and blackened, Ryan's glass cracked and fragmented. The two filing cabinets were now scorched hulks, their drawers exploded outward by the intense heat. What was left of my reports, printouts, and photos lay scattered across the floor as sodden sludge. The reek of smoke, seared metal, and liquefied plastic was so overpowering, my eyes began to burn and tears ran down my cheeks. And underlying the mix, another noxious note. Paint? Turpentine? I pictured the broken window downstairs, wondered again about an intruder. Could the added element I was smelling be an accelerant, such as gas or kerosene? Was I the victim of arson? Amid the wreckage, I spotted what survived of Ryan's Guy Lafleur bobblehead, my picture of Katie, the Nebulon frigate lamp, all twisted and distorted. My framed diplomas leaned cockeyed, glass shattered, documents torn, every component covered in soot. Propped against what was once the east wall was a blackened metal ladder. Flanking it, along the baseboard, were incinerated cans and remnants of what had been drop cloths and rags. Also amid the wreckage was my neighbor, dressed in bathrobe PJs and sneakers. A mask covered his mouth, and a fire extinguisher jutted from between his arms and his ribs. Walter? He turned and lowered the mask. Oh, Tempe, I am so sorry. What happened? I looked over and saw smoke billowing from your window, pointing the extinguisher's nozzle in that direction. Called 911, that was around 7. Thanks. Stunned mumble through fingers pressed to my lips. One responder said the fire appeared electrical in origin. A flying spark hit the rags and open paint and turpentine and boom, dramatized with exploding fingers. Apparently, the new smoke alarm wasn't functioning properly. Did you open the door for them? Knowing Walter had an emergency key to my place. Seriously? Right. The startled hand floating down to my chest. Disbelieving, I took in the devastation. They said it was one of those freak situations where the fire exploded, blew up fast and incredibly hot, then ran out of fuel and died without spreading to other parts of the house. They had a term for it. Flashover? I don't recall. I nodded, eyes still on the chaos. You can relax, though. The flames are totally out and the walls are cool. I checked. I didn't really trust that crew to be thorough, so I went over everything after the truck left. Twice. Raising the extinguisher. My grandfather was a firefighter. He always said secondary flare-ups were the real danger. Sudden, horrifying thought. My eyes flew to my desktop. The AC adapter was there, gnarled and melted. A lump of plastic that was once the mouse. Both were embedded in the charred wood on which they lay. My computer was gone. Blind fury ramrodded through the shock. Son of a bitch, where's my laptop? Where did you leave it? Walter, eyes roving. Ignoring the question and the gritty crunch of glass underfoot, I darted into the room and began rummaging through the mess. Walter set down the extinguisher and joined in the search. I suppose it could be on the lawn, he said after several fruitless minutes. They chucked things out the window. I raced down the stairs, fired through the door, and circled to the back of the annex. Shapes littered the ground, unidentifiable in the darkness. Frantic, I moved from object to object, desperately hoping my laptop had somehow been spared and lay among the jumble. I nearly cried when I found it. A hunk of blackened metal, melted keys, shattered fiber optic glass and circuit board. Devastated, I laid down the ruined Mac, hurried back inside and mounted the stairs. With trembling hands, I began picking up and setting aside random items, paper scraps, fragments of pillow stuffing, hunks of wire. At one point, Walter again offered his condolences, then took his leave, saying something about later retrieving his lamp. I paid no attention. How could Fred Frank have been so negligent? How could I have been so stupid? The small space must have been pyrotechnic. Why hadn't I checked the room following his abrupt departure? Why hadn't I personally tested the smoke alarm? Why hadn't I replaced the bungling twit? My self-recrimination was such that I didn't hear the SUV engine, the doorbell. The buzz of my mobile against my ass finally caught my attention. I answered.
You okay in there?
Best day of my life, white hot with anger at myself.
You want I should call a SWAT team, or you plan to answer the door?
I trudged downstairs, let Slidell in, and led him up to the study.
Holy fucking fuckville.
Poetic. Add a bleeding goat sound to that and you've got a hit. Mean, but I hated this. Hated Fred Frank and the equally inept electrician for causing it. Hated myself for letting it happen. Hated Slidell for being in my home. For being a witness to the disaster. Slidell's nose wrinkled and his face crimped.
That paint thinner I'm smelling?
I just glared at him.
What did you lose?
My laptop.
What else?
The Rolex and keys to the yacht. Slidell ignored my snark.
You got any idea?
Bad wiring and fumes, I snapped.
You keep any valuables in here? Jewelry? Electronics? Stuff you'll need to document for insurance purposes?
Isn't my goddamn laptop enough? I noticed that the front of Slidell's shirt was sweat-stained, in the shape of a newt, the holstered Glock at his hip fully exposed. Sorry, I added. I appreciate your coming.
It ain't the end of the world,
cocking his chin at the rubble. It sure as hell doesn't help our investigation. Everything related to the Vidyanov case is toast.
Yeah?
What the fire didn't destroy, my overly zealous neighbor turned into mush.
Like what?
The MCME file that Joe Hawkins gave me, the photos I printed, my notes, the scraps from Vodyanov's trench coat pocket, Lizzie Greiser's phenotype sketch and report. I just moved it all up here.
Your pal can print you another sketch.
That's not the point. Slidell scanned with professional eyes, then,
any chance it wasn't the wiring?
What are you saying?
You chafed someone's ass lately?
That scored him another livid glare.
The fire boys break that window downstairs?
I assume so. It's what they do, right? With big manly axes.
How's this play? Someone's caking his shorts not knowing what we've found. You being an easier target than a cop.
Slidell let the thought hang. Arson? Slidell didn't answer. Who?
You tell me.
How could I have been so stupid? The overload of adrenaline was making me shrill. so catastrophically careless.
Lose the drama, okay? You have a lot of pics on your phone, right?
I was having battery issues, so I transferred everything to my laptop.
You saved all your shit in the mist or the fog or whatever, right?
No. Slidell's brows floated up. Look, I've been a little freaked since Larrabee's death. Vodianov stalking me here didn't help. If he did stalk me here. Call it paranoia, whatever. I put nothing in the cloud.
You sent me the pics from your cell?
No. The call from Jerry Bruger, the subpoena, the outing to Lake Wiley, the news about Boyd. With so much happening, I'd totally forgotten to forward the images. Slidell gave the slightest of nods. Exposed wires, flickering lights, open paint and rags soaked in turpentine or whatever. Christ almighty, what was I thinking?
My opinion, it ain't all that straightforward.
Wait, you're seriously suggesting arson? That I was targeted?
I'm suggesting it ain't all that straightforward.
Small comfort. I was just as negligent about security. No lock on this door. A shocking consequence hit me hard. If what you're saying is true, then everything we had could now be in the hands of who? The very assholes we've been tracking?
Your laptop was password protected, right?
Of course it was. But I think I was hacked recently. Even if I wasn't, any high school techie worth his binary code can bypass or change a password. Hell, I know how to do that.
Reel it in,
Slidell gestured with downturned palms. He was right. I had made re-entry into Strident. I closed my eyes and took a deep breath. Before the exhale, another realization. I can't remember when I last cleared my browser history. If someone did break in, and if the creep logged onto my laptop before setting the fire, he would have seen my searches on Vodianov, Body, Timmer, MKUltra, the Estonia, my Google Earth visits, my trips to the dark web, deep under, homes at the end of the world, World's End House.
I get it.
And what about Joe Hawkins? What if the guy saw that file? Joe could lose his job for leaking it to me. Face legal action if Hefner decides to play hardball. What if the creep downloaded stuff onto a thumb drive or...
Give me some possibles.
Slidell yanked his notebook from a breast pocket, sweat-stained by the newt's tail. I had no idea of his meaning.
Say this wasn't random. Say it is arson. Give me some scenarios. Who? Why? Even if they're crazy, just keep talking.
I tangled with Hefner. That didn't go well. Half joking, half serious.
Motive?
Fear of disclosure is incompetent? Maybe even obstructive? It's been almost 2 weeks and still there's no ID on Vodianov, no cause of death.
Go on.
Nick Body?
Why?
Fear of exposure is a fraud? Of bad publicity?
The shitbird thrives on bad publicity.
Maybe Body learned that you and I are investigating his brother's death. Maybe he knew Felix had something to do with Jahan Cole's disappearance, with other kids going missing. Or maybe Nick himself was involved with the disappearances. Maybe he was responsible for Vodianov's death.
Who tipped him?
He and Hefner are old pals. Or it could have been someone at Sparkling Waters. Dr. Yuryev? Asia Barrow? Holly Kimry jumped me outside the gate to the fenced property. Maybe the place belongs to Body. Maybe Kimry's paid to do Body's dirty work. Maybe Body hired Kimry to torch the place. Slidell scribbled as I spoke. Vince Aiello? I was on a roll, spewing words with no thought. Maybe Aiello fears three strikes as a pedophile, and he's going down. Did you talk to him today? Maybe inadvertently clue him? Slidell's eyes rolled up and narrowed. Don't go there. Yates Timmer was unhappy that we showed up at his cottage. As understatements go, that one was epic. Maybe he had Bing follow me here from Lake Wiley last night, though I don't think the guy was in any shape to drive. Maybe Timmer ordered the fire. He could have had someone watching the annex. His goon saw me leave for dinner with Pete and struck.
Motive?
No idea. But Timmer's Deep Haven setup gives off a bad vibe. Slidell wiggled impatient fingers. Too much security, too little transparency for a realtor.
What he hawks ain't exactly standard.
Selling bunkers and missile silos is perfectly legal. Why employ a steroidal bouncer?
Any other ideas?
Jerry Bruger?
Who the fuck is Jerry Bruger?
A freelance journalist who called looking for intel on the Vodyanov case.
Would Bruger go that far?
If he thought the story would put a shine on his Wikipedia bio.
Others?
I lifted both palms and shoulders in frustration. Or maybe it was just turpentine and bad wiring. A beat as we both looked around. Slidell spoke first.
I'll send someone to slap plywood on this window and the one downstairs.
I can do it.
He'll do it faster.
Thanks. Detesting my role as a victim.
You want I should have CSU swing by in the morning? The arson boys?
What's the point? I said.
Can't hurt to establish someone torched the place. Dust for prints.
With little enthusiasm.
Don't touch.
I got it. When Slidell left, I tried phoning Ryan, was rolled a voicemail. Exhausted, I ignored my face and teeth and crawled into bed. A cue for my brain to begin trolling for worries over which to obsess. That night, the choices were endless. At one point, I heard banging, figured Slidell's minions had arrived to secure the window. Birdie joined me when the hammering stopped, probably peeved that his Call of the Wild portal had been sealed. I reached down to stroke his head.
So glad you weren't hurt,
mumbled, at last drowsy.
Was our arsonist a cat lover, or just a cat burglar? Did you charm him, or hunker down and sneak outside unnoticed?
Faulty wiring, or an intruder? Suddenly I was wide awake, struck by a horrifying thought. Had Birdie slipped out on his own when the downstairs window was broken or the back door opened? Or was he intentionally spared? If the latter, had leaving Birdie unharmed been intended to send a message? A message saying my intruder could have taken or killed my pet, but didn't? Was there an intruder? Was there a message? A message telling me who was in charge? A threat? A threat from whom? Or was my paranoia flaring again? Chapter 25. Wednesday, July 11th. CSU, the crime scene unit, showed up at 7. Slidell's arson boys. After they'd finished dusting the guest room study, I cleaned up the glass. No doubt a death sentence for the vacuum, but I wanted it gone. Next, using my phone, I emailed Lamange, explaining the fire and the demise of my laptop, and asking that copies of the Pascarol file be sent to the MCME. I'd planned to review all my reports and notes following dinner with Pete. Only 1 week until my testimony, and I was starting to get anxious. When CSU wrapped up in the upstairs office, I plowed through the charred chaos, found not a single readable document or viewable photo. What the fire hadn't consumed, the water from the hoses and the foam from the extinguisher had reduced to pulp. Slidell phoned as I was depositing another 5-gallon bag of slop into my outdoor trash bin.
Aiello's ass is parked in a room down the hall.
At the law enforcement center?
No, I booked him into the Ritz.
How did you persuade him to come in?
Told him his name came up in a cold case investigation.
He asked for no details?
I promised lots when he got here. Being an upstanding citizen, he agreed.
That and the fact I mentioned the old jacket on kiddie porn maybe implied I was debating a call to the state bar.
Will he bring counsel?
He mentioned that. I mentioned how I hoped the media didn't get wind of our chat.
I can be there in 20 minutes.
I want to sweat Aiello a while. Let him take a solo stroll down memory lane.
What time will you start?
11.
I'm in. I arrived on the second floor at 10:52. Slidell was not at his desk in the violent crimes division. He was not in the cold case unit. A detective named Conover thought he'd gone to question a witness. Gave me directions I didn't need. Hiding my annoyance, I thanked Conover,
hurried back up the hall and let myself into a space the size of my pantry. Leaving the overheads off, I stepped to a lighted rectangle on the right-hand wall. Through the one-way mirror, I could see the adjacent interrogation room, a stark duplicate of the one I was in. Same wall phone, same recording equipment, same institutional table and chairs. No red light glowed on the camera tucked high in one corner. I wonder if Aiello had balked at being taped. The audio was working. Objection or not, Slidell would have insisted on that. Slidell occupied one chair, his back to me. A yellow legal pad and a folder lay on the table before him, the contents of the latter mostly blocked by his bulk. The man opposite looked like he'd never visited a gym in his life, which I guessed had lasted maybe 50 years. His hair was dirty blonde, center-parted, and tucked behind his ears. His bottom lip was fuller than his top, giving his face a perpetual pout. Aiello shoved a paper across the tabletop. I assumed some type of waiver form. Tossed a pen after. When Slidell leaned forward to collect them, I caught my first glimpse of Aiello's eyes, Coke bottle green and bereft of feeling. Slidell was still in good cop mode.
Okay, Vince. Glad we got all that legal mumbo-jumbo out of the way. It's okay if I call you Vince?
Could we move this along?
I appreciate you coming in. You need anything? A coffee? A soda?
I'm good. Pointedly checking his watch, which was gold and the size of a manhole cover. Slidell shuffled his papers, selected and studied one, or appeared to, smiled, friendly as hell.
You've lived in Charlotte since...
Since 1984.
You're a lawyer, right?
I am.
You help folks protect their inventions?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Aiello took Slidell through a brief discourse on the U.S. Patent Act, exclusive rights, trademarks, limited monopolies, for all of which Slidell feigned avid interest. He appeared to take notes, finally laid down his pen.
You know how you can never fill up your bathtub? I got an idea for this gadget. Plugs the overflow drain, so's you can have a nice deep soak. Think that'd qualify?
Aiello listed the five requirements. Patentable subject matter, utility, novelty, non-obviousness, and enablement. Advised Slidell to apply for a utility patent, describing his device as a machine with a new useful purpose. Slidell listened, over-nodding.
Thanks. I'll do that.
Then, reading from a printout,
you live alone, right?
Last I checked, that's not a crime.
You own property in Dilworth.
We both know these things.
A house on Mount Vernon Avenue. That's near Latta Park, yeah?
As I said, I have a busy day. What's this all about?
Real pretty park. I used to walk my dog there.
Please spare me the small talk.
Will do.
Quick flick of a smile.
Tell me what you know about Felix Fadyanov.
Who? Clearly surprised at the question.
Felix Fadyanov.
Slowly. Don't know the man.
I think you do.
You are mistaken. Aiello tried to cross his arms on his chest. The parts involved were too large for the arrangement to work. The flabby forelimbs dropped back to the armrests, barely containing his torso.
We'll circle back to Fadyanov, Slidell said. Talk about his brother.
Who?
Nick Boddy. You three buddied up through Yates Timmer, correct?
I've never heard any of those names.
That's not the story coming from Timmer's muscle. According to Bing, you and Fadyanov had one hell of a throwdown.
You said you had questions about a cold case. Still cocky, but showing the first cracks.
He's cold enough.
What does that mean?
Fadyanov entered long-term parking right after the two of you went at each other.
Long-term parking?
He turned up dead.
I'm sorry for the man's misfortune. Slidell switched tacks, an old trick to catch a witness off guard.
Twist. That's an odd handle. How'd you get it?
Seconds passed. Aiello looked like he was counting the concrete blocks in the wall to Slidell's left, or deciding on a strategy.
"Probably not your dancing skills," Slidell said.
"Boo-ha. The cop does comedy."
"I'm guessing it's a reference to your favorite pastime."
The pouty lips tightened. Slidell pulled a photo from his file and skimmed it across the table. Through the speaker, the paper made a slithery hissing sound. Through the glass, I caught a flash of bright pink beads.
"Jahan Cole."
Slidell's words were suddenly curdled with loathing.
"She was 9 when some degenerate piece of shit yanked her out of her life. You get your rocks off leering at naked kids, twist. You know anything about that?"
Aiello's Adam's apple took a roller coaster ride in his fleshy throat.
"Look at her."
Slidell finger jabbed the image. Aiello glanced down, quickly away.
"What happened to her?"
"I have no idea."
"I think you're lying."
"Okay, fine. I heard about her on the news." The Coke bottle eyes were now round and flat. "Everyone did, because of past difficulties. I was caught up in the hysteria, questioned illegally. I had an alibi. I wasn't in Charlotte when the child disappeared." Skinny knew the Cole file inside and out, knew Aiello hadn't been a suspect. I understood his motive. The chair leg screeched as Slidell popped to his feet and leaned across the table. When he spoke again, nose inches above Aiello's, his voice was low and dangerous.
"That's the cold case I want to talk about, you dumb prick."
Sending droplets of spit into Aiello's face.
"Only this one's never going cold on my watch. So, you want we should dive down that hole? Or maybe you're suddenly remembering your pals?"
Aiello raised a hand to wipe the saliva from his skin, reconsidered, and dropped it.
"I'm waiting, asshole."
Aiello held perfectly still a moment before responding. "Please step away." Slidell hesitated, then dropped back into his chair. "Nick Boddy is a radio personality, but I'm sure you are cognizant of that fact."
"He's a boil on the butt cheek of humanity, but go on."
"Boddy has a large national audience, but avoids the limelight when off air." Aiello was choosing his words carefully. "He fervently safeguards his privacy and allows very few into his inner circle. I am not one of those few."
"You met Boddy through Timmer?"
"I did."
"Timmer sells real estate."
"He does."
"What's Deep Haven?"
"My word, detective. You have done some digging."
"You need I should repeat the question?"
"Deep Haven is a sort of social club."
"For suckers buying into Boddy's conspiracy bullshit?"
"Nothing like that. Boddy and his brother are mere members, like the rest of us." Another pause for word choice. "Deep Haven is a gathering place for those sharing the same concerns as Yates Timmer."
"Wackadoos wanting to live underground."
"In his day, Edward Jenner was considered a wackadoo. You're familiar with Jenner, of course?" Raising supercilious brows. "Vaccination?"
"Talk about Vodyanov."
Aiello said nothing.
"You need a visual aid on him, too?"
Sharp.
"I got one. It ain't pretty."
"I hardly knew the man."
"You fought with him. He attacked me." "Was Vodyanov into hard candy like you?"
Slidell's face was red and moving toward Claret.
"You two pair up to ogle toddlers out of their diapers."
Aiello's eyes returned to the concrete blocks.
"Why was Vodyanov carrying info on this kid?"
Slidell snatched up Cole's photo, glowering hard. "If you'll calm down and keep your distance, I'll tell you what I know." Again, the arm cross failed. "But this cannot get back to Deep Haven."
"Those cretins are the least of your worries,"